You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Max toku ingoa, no mai haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā for Wednesday. I'm your host Max and I'll be with you for the next hour. Fi Akine coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, Wednesday Wire. We spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March about the Green Party's pledge to revoke what they consider the most destructive fast-track mining consents handed out by the current government, the adjustments to the Clean Car Standard and the official passing of the Regulatory Standards Bill into law. I also spoke with John Minto from the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa to discuss the UN Security Council voting 13-0 in favour of implementing US President Donald Trump's plan for a lasting peace in Gaza. News and editorial director Joel spoke to Jeffrey Bertram, a visiting scholar and retired lecturer at the Victoria University of Wellington, about the passing of the Regulatory Standards Bill and what this means heading forward. They also spoke to Peter Thompson, an associate media and communications professor at the Victoria University of Wellington and board member of the Better Public Media Trust, about ACT MP Laura McClure's members' bill proposing the disestablishment of the Broadcasting Standards Authority. He aho o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patohi mai, text in on 5395. Ko wai e wareware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, he pakihere, roki maronga i te pai, tuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
On Monday, the Green Party announced that a Green government will commit to revoking any consents or permits handed out under the fast-track process for coal, hard rock gold and seabed mining if they were to be permitted under the current government. In their announcement, the Greens were adamant that it was possible to have an economy that employs people without destroying the ecological basis for our existence, while expressing that they consider these forms of mining to be deeply destructive and unsustainable. Also this week, Transport Minister Chris Bishop announced new changes to the Clean Car Standard. In the new standards, importers will now be charged $15 per gram of CO2 for new imports, compared to the previous $67.50, a nearly 80% reduction. This has led to criticism from experts who believe New Zealand will now become a dumping ground for high-emission vehicles. And last week, the Green Party also condemned the government's decision to officially pass the Regulatory Standards Bill into law. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke to MP Ricardo Menendez March about the new Clean Car Standard as well as the Regulatory Standards Bill being passed. But first, we discussed the Greens' commitment to revoking any mining permits handed out under the fast-track process.
They have not yet been granted and are, and the forms of mining that we have signalled are some of the most harmful forms of mining towards the environment, as well as the reality that these forms of mining will just be a short-term sugar hit for the economy at the expense of sustainable jobs and protecting te tāio. So what we have announced basically is that should the Greens get back into government, we are committed to revoking these consents. In that sense, a strong signal to polluting industries that are not serious about creating a large amount of jobs, that they are not welcome in this country, and that should we have a progressive government, we'll instead invest in creating 40,000 jobs in the Green Jobs for Nature program, as well as in manufacturing and construction.
Is there a plan to replace the economic value that will be lost by revoking these permits specifically?
Absolutely, and as I've just spoken, we release our Greens industrial strategy that shows that we can create instead tens of thousands of jobs, which is a much, much larger amount than what these mining jobs would have created in areas like manufacturing. A really good example, for example, to elucidate on that is that right now we export raw construction materials that then we end up importing back once they are manufactured overseas. We think that we should build that manufacturing capacity here in the country to lower the cost of construction materials, as well as to create jobs and industries that are far more sustainable, that can create long-term benefits, and that can also help us deal with the housing crisis.
By announcing this early, are you saying that the Green Party won't be providing financial aid to anybody who loses work because of this?
We are committed. Well, A, it's important to note that there are no jobs yet as a result of these projects. These are consents that have not yet been granted. And hopefully that will send a strong signal to those industries that we're going to have a government that will instead invest in more sustainable forms of job creation. We will focus on supporting workers who may be affected by this to transition into other jobs. That's why we've long called for a just transition for workers. And so we will create a Green Ministry of Works to assist us with the planning and the transition towards that. But our goal is to ensure that there are enough jobs available for people, unlike this government that has chosen to cut thousands and thousands of jobs, and the jobs that they're creating through these future consenting projects will actually amount to a fraction of the jobs that they have cut.
So basically you're saying that if the Greens are in Parliament, you'll be revoking all of these permits. So anyone that's looking to currently get a job with these permits, they just shouldn't bother.
Well, there's no jobs yet for these permits that have yet been granted. And to just make it really clear, these are the consents that we are committed to revoking are some of the most harmful to the environment that will actually result in genuine health harms as well to people in those areas. And this is why instead we think that we should be creating tens of thousands of jobs, far more than these consents would have granted, in areas that create long-term jobs, like in construction, manufacturing, as well as in the Green Jobs for Nature program. And we will support any workers affected by this, which is a fraction of the jobs that the government has cut, to transition into other industries, unlike the government that has not meaningfully provided a transition for workers who they've made jobless as a result of the job cuts that they have led.
Is this a strictly green policy, or have you spoken to someone like the Labour Party about this as well?
We gave the Labour Party a heads up, but what we're really clear is that it's up to the voters to choose the kind of policies that they want. If they want us to build 40,000 jobs in much more sustainable industries that also create better long-term benefits, only a party vote for the Green guarantees a change of government and genuine progressive policy that delivers tens of thousands of jobs for people.
All right, moving on to the next topic. Transport Minister Chris Bishop announced the government would be making significant changes to the clean car standard. They cited that most importers are unable to meet the targets under the current scheme as it currently stands. Importers will now be charged $15 per gram of CO2 for new imports instead of $67.50, marking a drop of nearly 80%. My next question is, what was the Green Party's reaction to the new clean car standard released by the government?
The previous government's approach to ensuring that more people could have electric vehicles was actually working. We were creating a market of second-hand-owned electric vehicles that more and more people could access, and that helps us reduce emissions within the transport sector. But what the government has chosen to do time and time again has been to gut those very same policies and effectively take us back to the previous national government, where we continued to be a country where the industry could just choose to pass on older vehicles that are more high emissions producing and just less efficient. The reality is that we've got a government that is not serious about reducing emissions in the transport sector. And when they are not adequately investing in things like public transport and rail, including interregional rail, and at the very same time gutting one of the policies that we know was working in the medium to long term when it came to giving people more access to electric vehicles, it just shows that they're not serious about addressing A, the cost of living crisis, as well as our climate crisis.
Do you think that Chris Bishop has a case here when he says that the change is to save consumers money?
Not taking action on climate change actually will create more costs for people in the medium to long term. And we're already experiencing some of those costs from climate inaction, whether it be the impacts that are still being felt from the 2023 floods, as well as more frequent climate change events. The government should instead be better supporting the importing of quality electric vehicles that can then be accessed by people from all ranges of incomes, as well as better investment in things like interregional rail and public transport, which are far more sustainable modes of transport, to give people the options to get around to school, to work, in a way that's actually cheaper than the current options that people have.
Will the Green Party look to reverse this decision if they were to be in government next year?
We have long supported having policies that better enable the importing of electric vehicles, and particularly in a way that we can create a second-hand market so that people from all incomes can access electric vehicles. But let's make something really, really clear. The biggest thing we can do to lower the costs of transport as well as to reduce emissions in the transport space is to invest in public transport, including into regional rail, to give people more options and affordable options to move around to work, to school, and to meet their family members in other parts of the country.
Some experts are saying that this change will lead to New Zealand becoming a dumping ground for high-emission vehicles. Is that something that you agree with?
We have long been concerned that our vehicle fleet is old and high emissions, and the changes that the government is proposing risk taking us back to that time. We were already making good progress when it came to having more electric vehicles in our fleet. And by having more of those vehicles and having a greater secondhand market of electric vehicles, we also were broadening the base of incomes that people could access those electric vehicles. But again, going back to the core principle, the Greens want to invest in more public transport, more into regional rail, so that we actually become a modern country where people have options to get around to school, to work, or travel between towns.
All right, moving on to the last topic. Last week, the Green Party condemned the government's decision to officially pass the Regulatory Standards Bill into law. The Labour Party has confirmed that it will repeal this bill if they were to be in government, and Green Party co-leader Marama Davidson echoed this, saying, quote, "The Greens will repeal this waste of time and money." My next question is, what are the main issues of this bill, according to the Green Party, and why do you see this as a sad time for Aotearoa?
Oh, look, we didn't have to wait until the third reading ourselves to make it really clear to the public that we would be repealing this. And part of the issue with this bill is that the government is pushing through legislation which effectively embeds David Seymour's political ideology into lawmaking. And this is putting corporate profits and the interests of the rich ahead of everyday people by way of how we design legislation. He claims that good lawmaking is about putting the interests of property owners ahead of the collective well-being of, for example, communities, hapu anyui. And this is why we oppose this bill, because at the end of the day, all this bill does is entrench the principles of David Seymour into lawmaking. And he's hypocritical AF. Like, basically, he talks about good lawmaking when he has supported bills being introduced through urgency with not adequate scrutiny, which is exactly what he claims he wants to address.
Obviously, the bill has faced widespread criticism from the public. Do you see this as a total appeasement of the ACT Party by the government that they would then pass this bill?
It's more than appeasement. It's complicity. It's the reality that we've got a prime minister that is so willing to hold onto power that he'll happily support policies that he knows will make life worse for everyday people. Make no mistake, because this bill effectively, what it does, it creates a set of values that puts profit before people and the planet and society. And what this will do is it will create a sea of yellow tape that will prevent lawmakers hoping to put the well-being of our communities at the forefront, and will create barriers for us to do things like addressing poverty, like returning land to Māori, like ensuring that we protect the natural environment against oil companies that seek to destroy it. And this is why this bill is dangerous, and we are committed to repealing it at the first opportunity.
Is that something that should be questioned, that the government would then pass a bill that most people don't want to see in just because the ACT Party want to see it in? Should that be questioned?
I think this is a government that's showing its true colours, that they don't care about what the common person may think. And at the end of the day, they will sell their souls to the highest bidder. We've seen that, and they're handing out billions of dollars to big landlords, to big tobacco and fossil fuel companies. And this is why we are committed to repealing this bill, but also not just to change the government, but to have a government that is genuinely committed to working for everyday people as opposed to the interests of big corporates.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the Green Party's decision to revoke mining permits handed out through the fast-track process, the new changes to the Clean Car Standard, and the Regulatory Standards Bill.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
The Wire.
Recently, the controversial Regulatory Standards Bill passed its third and final reading. The bill has raised concerns amongst many for a variety of reasons, including its lack of recognition of te tiriti or waitangi, the risks it poses to the environment, and what opponents say is its narrow neoliberal framework. The bill, during public submissions, received 156,000 submissions, with over 98% voicing their opposition to the proposed legislation. News and editorial director Joel spoke to Jeffrey Bertram, a visiting scholar and retired lecturer at the Victoria University of Wellington, about the bill, why it is so polarising, and what the passing of this bill means heading forward.
I want to take a step back first and ask, what is the Regulatory Standards Bill, especially in this final iteration?
And the final iteration, frankly, is very close to the original. It's, from my point of view, a very extreme measure to impose a very strong set of ideological suppositions onto the behaviour of the New Zealand government. And it's important to recognise that this bill is not just an isolated example. It's part of what has been a very long-running campaign since the 1980s by what I would call neoliberal thinkers, based really on a bunch of United States work, trying to tie the hands of the government and prevent government from pursuing the sort of welfare state or activist agenda that we used to see governments around the Western world performing in the 20th century. And so in a whole series of acts that have gone through the New Zealand Parliament, there are things that tie the hands of government and its agencies to prevent it from doing things that neoliberals object to. The State-Owned Enterprises Act way back in 1986 prevented government businesses from acting in a socially responsible way unless they made a profit at it. The principles of responsible fiscal policy were built into the Public Finance Act starting 1996 and then again in 2004. And those principles have tied the ministers of finance to small government, low taxes, low debt targets, which prevented the government from stepping in to do things that needed to be done in infrastructure and health and education and so on. And now the Regulatory Standards Bill is putting into legislation a great deal of red tape. While proponents of the bill talk about removing red tape, in actual fact, the Regulatory Standards Bill is a way of putting red tape everywhere in the path of government ministers wanting to do something. By requiring them to show that what they're doing is consistent with a set of very restrictive, very right-wing principles designed to protect property rights and completely ignoring things like te tiriti or waitangi and all sorts of other things that most New Zealanders want their governments to respect. This bill just gives total primacy to private property to be protected above all else. And it means that any time government encroaches on private property, it finds itself entangled in a web of requirements to declare compliance and to face cross-questioning from a new sort of star chamber that has been set up called the Regulatory Standards Board. At the same time, the chief executives of government departments, who usually work to the direction of and responsible to the ministers who hold the portfolios, for example, the Minister of Health is the minister to whom the chief executive of the Ministry of Health is accountable. Well, under this bill now, the chief executives of all the government ministries are accountable to the Regulatory Standards Bill and hence to the Minister of Regulation. In other words, David Seymour as Minister has set himself up as a super authority above the heads of all the other ministers in the government, and he can summon the chief executives of the other agencies without them having to get a clearance from their ministers to come before the Regulatory Standards Bill and answer a whole series of quite intrusive questions about the way that they're implementing the regulations and the legislation that their ministry is responsible for. At the same time, the Regulatory Standards Bill is able to use the machinery of the High Court to force all sorts of people to appear before the board to be cross-questioned on their conduct. And this extends all the way down to the non-government agencies that have contracts to provide services out there in the community, things like home care and so on. All the way down the chain, anybody operating under any piece of legislative authority on behalf of the public sector in New Zealand can be summoned before this board to be cross-questioned on what they're up to. It's a hugely intrusive, very time-consuming process, which is going to tie up a lot of public service staff and resources in endless filling out of forms and paperwork and writing reports, all just for the satisfaction of the Minister of Regulation. And to my mind, the two clear purposes of this bill, which it performs extremely well, are firstly to narrow the focus of government action and prevent government doing anything to encroach on private property. The other thing is to slow down the entire machinery of government by bogging it down in precisely the sort of minuscule red tape that the ACT Party and others always complain about the private sector being subject to. In other words, they've taken the narrative story of the private sector finding itself always stuck with compliance and form filling. They've taken that mechanism as they imagine it to be and applied it to try to slow the government down. So the whole exercise, to my mind, is firstly very anti-democratic, because it means that any government getting elected with a mandate to really pursue the common good, where that is sometimes at the expense of big private vested interests like the electricity monopolists or the supermarkets or the oil companies, suddenly finds itself up against this brick wall of compliance requirements to show that it hasn't encroached on private property rights without paying compensation. It's a huge chilling effect on what I would regard often as democratically required action by the government. So not only is it anti-democratic, but it's inefficient because of its clear purpose to make government less efficient, not more efficient. So on several fronts, I think it's a great pity that Parliament has put this bill through, and I very much hope that it will be very quickly repealed if the government changes.
Yeah, speaking to which, the opposition has declared that this act would be repealed if we do see a change in government. Could you see this act lasting a long time, or is it too early to say?
It really depends on the next election. My hope is that any government that put legislation like this through would be immediately rejected by the electorate. I mean, that involves taking a deep breath and saying, I do have faith in the general wisdom of the voting population to know when it's being fed poison. And so we just have to hope that the next election, the government does change. And we then have to hope that if indeed the government does change, that it does proceed to repeal this law. That can be a difficulty, because once government changes, a huge amount depends on the negotiations that produce the new government, and which parties are involved in those negotiations obviously will colour the outcome. So, you can imagine a world in which this Act would remain on the statute books for a while longer. I think that would be a pity, and I think in due course we would learn that it was a mistake, but I can't guarantee you that it will not last beyond the change of government.
That was the Victoria University of Wellington's Geoffrey Bertram on the passing of the Regulatory Standards Bill and what this means heading forward. We'll be right back after this short break.
95 BFM Drive Island at the Bay Spot Morningside with Crystal Chen and Joe Captain, Friday, November 28th from 4 to 7 p.m.
Tunes, pints and the folks from your fave radio station? What more could you want on a sunny Friday arvo? So cruise down and enjoy some jazzy tunes from the talented Crystal Chen and the prolific Joe Captain.
Drive Island at the Bay Spot Morningside from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, November 28th. Thanks to McLeod's and NZ On Air.
Garth, Garth, where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no hat, no play summer. So it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
The bleeding edge of brunch time radio.
Morning Glory.
A 95BFM institution.
More BFM than screwing up the news stings.
More BFM than that ad you remember from 10 years ago.
The freshest tunes and the freshest talent. Getting you through your daily grind every weekday morning.
Morning Glory.
10 a.m. to midday, Monday to Friday. Only on 95BFM.
Brought to you by The Tuning Fork.
He finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7 p.m. every weekday, only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the Beer Spot, your tappy place.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879. Yesterday, the United Nations Security Council voted 13-0 in favour of US President Donald Trump's resolution for lasting peace in Gaza, although Russia and China chose to abstain. The plan includes vague references to Palestinian statehood in the future, along with the deployment of an international stabilization force in Gaza. Supporters of the resolution suggest it should lead to the immediate lifting of remaining opposition to the flow of aid into Gaza, and the creation of an international stabilization force would fill the vacuum left by the withdrawal of Israeli troops from the region, while allowing for immediate measures required to feed and protect the 2.2 million Palestinians living in the region. To discuss Donald Trump's latest plan for lasting peace in Gaza and what it means for Palestine and Hamas, I spoke with Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa co-chair John Minto. Firstly, what did you make of the UN Security Council voting to endorse this resolution?
Well, I think it's a bad move. This resolution is about the recolonization of Palestine. It's really about imposing on Palestinians a government not of their choosing, and it is a resolution which does not respect international law or the rights of Palestinians to self-determination in their own land. So from that point of view, it's bad for Palestinians. It really means that the colonization of Palestine will continue and Palestinians will be further marginalized from that process by the Americans with this resolution.
The reference to Palestinian statehood was a late addition to the draft after the US version didn't initially include it. Does that make you worried that it's not a serious proposal?
Exactly. The Americans don't want a Palestinian state, and because Israel doesn't want a Palestinian state, and Israel has been determined, and when I say Israel, I'm talking about the current Israeli government plus every other party, apart from one, I think, in the Israeli parliament. They do not support a Palestinian state. They want all of the land of Palestine and none of the Palestinian people. They are running in apartheid state at the moment. So there is no support inside Israel for a Palestinian state. In fact, there's hostility to it, and therefore the US doesn't want a Palestinian state. So Palestinians are left with the global solidarity movement, which represents the vast majority of humanity, on their side. But the governments of the world, particularly the Western elites and the Arab world, are not with Palestine.
Yeah, like you said, the current version of the Israeli government doesn't want a Palestinian state. One day before the vote, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu expressed his adamant opposition to the creation of that state. My question is, what kind of serious opposition can Netanyahu provide to this plan, and should that be taken as a threat?
Oh, it should. I think Netanyahu has a long history, and in fact Israeli leaders going back to 1948 have a long history of manipulating documents like this to grab the bits of them they want and reject the ones they don't want. So Israel will be working fiercely hard. They'll be lobbying really hard the US Congress and other Western leaders to try and get the bits of this document that they don't like just buried. So some things will be set aside. They'll be set aside at Israel's insistence, and other bits which Israel wants will go ahead. So the main aim is to disenfranchise, to disempower, to destroy all possibilities of a Palestinian state, and to expel the Palestinian population from Gaza and from the West Bank. Israel's been doing this for since 1948. It's been stealing Palestinian land every day, and this resolution will give them cover to continue to do that day by day, week by week, as they have in the past. And in fact, in the last 20 months, they have accelerated this dispossession of Palestinians from their land. We've just had the olive harvest, for example, take place, where Palestinians gather their olives from their olive groves, and the Israeli settlers across the West Bank have been attacking people or attacking Palestinians, in fact attacking supporters of Palestinians who have been there to try and deflect these attacks on Palestinians from Israeli settlers. They have made life a real misery, and that what I'm saying is that process is accelerating now under the cover of the genocide that's going on in Gaza, and that's continuing to go on in Gaza despite the ceasefire.
Despite the vague wording on Palestinian statehood, many major European and Arab countries said they were willing to compromise in order to extend the truce and to feed and protect the 2.2 million Palestinians in Gaza. Should we take this as a good sign, or is that something that should be a given?
Well, it should be a given that, protecting people who are living under a military occupation from the cruelty and the depravity of the occupying power should be a given. But I think these countries lack the political will to stand firmly with Palestine and reject what the US and Israel are trying to force on Palestinians. I think it's going to require those Western leaders and Arab leaders to be forced to do the right thing by their population. So here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, the movement here is determined to force our government to do the right thing, because our government is not and will not do it without being forced to do it.
After the vote, Hamas rejected what it described as an imposed international guardianship mechanism and insisted it will not disarm. Do you think Hamas will ever willingly disarm? And if so, what would it take?
No, they won't willingly disarm until there is a free Palestine, and peace based on justice for Palestinians. No, they won't disarm. And why should they disarm? This would be like calling on Hamas to disarm is like calling on the French resistance to disarm in the face of the Nazi occupation of France during the Second World War. Well, Palestinians are not going to disarm in the face of the illegal Israeli occupation of their land. And that was confirmed by the International Court of Justice in July 2024, when they said Israel's occupation of the occupied Palestinian territories was illegal and gave Israel 1 year to get out of those areas. Israel, of course, has ignored that. But the really important point here is that once again, it is the people of the world that will be holding our governments to account to force them to allow for Palestinian self-determination.
Do Hamas have a point when they say they don't want the guardianship of the Board of Peace provided by US President Donald Trump?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, why should Palestinians accept leadership or governance or imposed authority by anyone else? By Israel, by the US, by the international community? Palestinians deserve the right to self-determination that is their birthright. And what needs to happen is the Israeli apartheid state needs to be dismantled to allow the formation of a Palestinian government in Palestine from the river to the sea, where everybody has equal rights. Well, people don't have equal rights there at the moment. We have a system of racial supremacy based on Jewish supremacy in Palestine. That has to be replaced by equal rights for everybody.
That was Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa co-chair John Minto on the UN Security Council voting 13-0 in favour of Donald Trump's latest plan for peace in Gaza, and why he believes it's the latest attempt by many in the West to colonise the region. We'll be right back after a short break.
Gotta slow up, gotta shake this high. Gotta take a minute just to ease my mind. Cause if I don't walk, then I get caught out. Falling all the way down. 100 headlights making me blind. All of your pleasures catching my eye. If I jump once, then I never think twice. But your temptations making me stay another night. And my senses only lie to me, lie to me. I don't know how it feels so right to me, right to me. I gotta check myself before I get what I want. Find out it's not what I thought it was. Tell myself leave while I'm still strong. Don't look back till I'm 10 miles gone. And when the road stops, I'm gonna keep on until I end up in the place that I belong. But the pressure's pushing me back again, telling me not to pretend. There's any use even trying to get you out my head. So I lift my feet off the ground and I'm gonna walk right out. Gotta slow up, gotta shake this high. Gotta take a minute just to ease my mind. Cause if I don't walk, then I get caught out. And I'll be falling all the way down. Turn my head and shut my eyes. Doesn't even matter if I'm wrong or right. Cause if I don't walk, I keep messing around. And I'll be falling all the way down. Won't get caught in the old fly trap. Run away, never come back. No way I'm going down like that. No, no, run away, run away. Whoa. I can get caught up again. No way, no, no. Gotta slow up, gotta shake this high. Gotta take a minute just to ease my mind.
Well, first of all, I love it. Clearly you've given up on trying to have any sort of neutrality in this interview.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Once again, please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879. Recently, ACT Party MP Laura McClure has launched a members' bill proposing the disestablishment of the Broadcasting Standards Authority, or BSA. This members' bill follows a complaint laid to the BSA regarding Sean Plunkett's online media network, The Platform. Plunkett, the content of his show does not meet the requirements of the Broadcasting Act, and that the BSA had woefully and egregiously overstepped its bounds. The BSA, however, says Plunkett's show clearly meets the requirements of the Act. News and editorial director Joel spoke to Peter Thompson, an associate media and communications professor at the Victoria University of Wellington and board member of the Better Public Media Trust, about this members' bill and what the bill is proposing.
What is the BSA?
Well, the Broadcasting Standards Authority is a quasi-judicial body that's responsible for implementing the broadcasting standards under the Broadcasting Act 1989. Now, there are a range of different standards there. That includes dealing with offensive and disturbing content, children's interests, promotion of illegal antisocial behaviour, discrimination or degradation, balance, accuracy, privacy and fairness. And it applies those standards through a complaints mechanism to both radio and television and online content that has also been broadcast.
We'll touch on the online side of, I guess, what the BSA regulates in a second. And you kind of touched on this next point a little bit, but what is the origin of the BSA? How and why did it start up in the first place?
If you go back a long, long way back in time, I mean, back to the 70s, then the 80s, there was a broadcasting tribunal. And when there was the overhaul of the broadcasting sector, where both BCNZ, which was the sort of state monopoly umbrella company, split up into two, both of which became commercial enterprises, state-owned enterprises, and that was RNZ and TVNZ. And that was the time when commercial competition was opened up, both particularly in television but also radio, and to make sure that broadcasters took account of their potential power and didn't abuse it, they created a regulatory body, and that regulatory body was the Broadcasting Standards Authority. And as I say, it's tasked with developing codes and standards. It evolves those in consultation with both industry and the public, and it does have some judicial powers. It can fine you up to $5,000, which might have sounded a lot back in 1989, but certainly doesn't sound very much today. But it does have a couple of other powers which it has used only in very rare and egregious situations, and that's where it can order someone to cease broadcast for 24 hours or to stop carrying advertising for up to 24 hours. And it's very, very careful about using that. It doesn't usually go that far. For the most part, its regulation simply means that it issues rulings, and it can basically, you know, demand that the media, you know, put a notice on air that they made a mistake and that they've had to correct it or apologise.
A large part of why this members' bill now exists stems from a complaint regarding Sean Plunkett's online media network, The Platform. Does the BSA have any authority in this sort of digital space?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, because if you go and read the Broadcasting Act, it's actually a bit fuzzy about this. There's a view out there, particularly on the political right, that the BSA is some sort of Orwellian bureaucracy akin to the Stasi, which, I'm sorry, is just patent nonsense. But there is an argument that its function in trying to address contemporary digital media services using an act that was still dated back to 1989 is always going to be rather difficult. So it was one argument that says, well, the letter of the law doesn't specifically mention online media, and therefore it can't do it. On the other hand, because it doesn't mention online media, you might argue that broadcasting-like services that do function online are therefore subject to the standards, and that's the principle of treating similar kinds of media and similar kinds of content with the same principles and regulatory mechanisms. So, you know, it's an interesting case. I actually think the law is perfectly ambiguous on this, but certainly it's upset a number of online platforms, not only Sean Plunkett, I imagine, because some media actors operate online precisely because they thought they were immune to any kind of regulation, and they can say whatever the heck they like.
Does the BSA regulate? I mean, we've seen a push with places like RNZ and the Herald to digitise their content to make it more easily accessible to a lot more people, because, you know, we're seeing a large push towards the digital space. Does the BSA regulate like those sort of companies? What differentiates the platform here?
There are gaps in the legislation. At the moment, print media and online news is covered primarily by the New Zealand Media Council. Now, that was the Press Council, and there was also the Online Media Standards Authority. They're both industry bodies. They don't have any statutory powers, and you basically agree to be subject to their jurisdiction, primarily as a motif of your professional media practices and your willingness to be held accountable to standards. But at the moment, there's no regulator specific to online media. Now, if I'm TVNZ or if I'm News Talk ZB and I broadcast something on air, you know, that's automatically subject to the BSA. If I put something online and I stream it, then that would normally fall under the jurisdiction of the New Zealand Media Council. But if it's also broadcast, then the BSA is allowed to take complaints about it. So you can see it's a bit patchworky. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why earlier this year the government decided that it wanted to put out a proposal to modernise the media regulatory frameworks. And one of the conversations that has ensued from that is whether or not we ought to extend the BSA's jurisdiction more generically to cover online media. Now, from my point of view, that makes perfect sense, because it means that similar kinds of content would be subject to similar kinds of regulatory principles and potentially consequences. So if I'm doing something that looks like radio or television, smells like radio and television, and captures a big audience like radio and television, then, you know, the principle is, well, I should take some responsibility for making sure that the kinds of content I'm putting out adhere to standards like basic accuracy, fairness, you know, balance principles. But there are some actors that don't want that. And I think you have to ask a very pertinent question as to why they don't think that those sorts of rules apply to them.
McClure, in announcing this members' bill, says there are already laws against defamation and obscenity. Are these laws enough to counter what the BSA was established for in the first place?
No.
I mean, fair enough.
It's just clearly not the case at all. Really, I mean, this bill is an ideological knee-jerk reaction, pandering to a particular constituency on the political right. Hasn't been thought through at all. The idea that you would completely get rid of the media regulator that's there to uphold core standards, you know, in a digital environment where we're beset with a proliferation of disinformation and all kinds of problematic content, is just grossly irresponsible. I mean, for me, you've got to ask yourself why the alt-right and libertarians like ACT are so keen to get rid of media regulations. I mean, the only thing that this bill would do is enable private media corporations to operate with impunity in pumping out propaganda and disinformation. And the cost of that would be a further erosion of our democracy. I mean, how anyone could think this was a sensible idea if they actually believe in democratic principles is absolutely beyond me. It's preposterous.
ACT is obviously at the forefront of this members' bill, but have we seen any indication whatsoever from other parties or even MPs in Parliament that they are feeling a similar way about the BSA?
I'm pretty sure that the Labour Party wouldn't want to abolish the BSA, but I think where the parties might agree is that we need media reform, and where I would agree with ACT is that the current 1989 broadcasting legislation is way out of date and not fit for purpose. The BSA agrees with that. So, you know, I think the idea that we need reform is not controversial, and it was the current government that actually put forward the proposal to modernise media regulation and potentially expand the remit of the BSA or some other kind of regulatory framework to take account of the fact that there are so many new forms of media that fall outside the current legislation. So I don't think any other party would go as far as ACT and simply say, well, okay, we'll leave it to the market. Consumers can decide. If you don't like it, don't watch it. We don't need any regulation. I think that's a charter for the irresponsible and the ideological media moguls to do whatever the heck they like with impunity. I think it's absolutely irresponsible and it's utterly dangerous to democracy. Now, does that mean the BSA was right to hear a complaint about the platform? I don't know. I think the law is ambiguous on that point. And I also think that maybe they were given a nudge to go and try and see what would happen if they heard a complaint about an online platform, or the platform in this case. So I think that remains to be seen. But is there a need to overhaul the current regulatory framework? Yes. And people have been saying that for a couple of decades now. I mean, there were moves in 2008 to implement a review of regulation for digital media and broadcasting. There was the convergence review in 2015 under National. So multiple governments have introduced plans to reform the regulatory model. The problem is that by the time they've decided what they want to do, a new government comes in and rips up the blueprint. And that's why we're here where we are now.
If this bill was to, hypothetically, if this bill was to be pulled from the biscuit tin and passed, what would this mean for regulation in this space? Would there be any regulation at all?
There's regulation of a form. There's the Classification Office that deals primarily with film, video games, other forms of content. They can put labels on content. They can also declare certain sorts of content objectionable. So, for example, after the Christchurch terror attacks, that video and manifesto were deemed objectionable by the chief censor. So they regulate content, and they also play a role in putting labels, or they have a labels regime, I should say, that the subscription providers operate under. So when you go online to Netflix or Disney Plus or Neon, then they should carry a label about the nature of their content, and it's the Classification Office that oversees that. But they don't do broadcasting. News media currently falls under the New Zealand Media Council. They're pretty professional, but they don't have any legal powers. And if I was running a newspaper and I just decided that I didn't want to uphold the basic principles of accuracy or fairness or balance, then all they could do is censure me, and there's really nothing they could do to force me to comply unless I'd grossly defame someone. So there are places where the defamation laws and privacy laws probably would play a role, but they're nowhere near adequate, for dealing with these core principles under which the media are able to function in a positive way and uphold democracy and an informed citizenship. The idea that you would simply abandon these as an ideological knee-jerk reaction, cannot come from a place that's respectful of the democratic process. In fact, it's a direct threat to it.
You've touched on this throughout the interview, but how should the regulatory framework be reformed instead of what Laura McClure is proposing here?
I think we need another interview to get into the details of that. There's a number of different models, but I mean, model number one is you create a generic regulator, which might be the BSA or it might be another entity, and you give it certain powers and give it certain codes and principles to uphold, such as accuracy and balance and fairness and privacy and non-denigration. And that would apply to any sort of content, that, particularly under broadcasting or mass media types of process. I don't think it would necessarily apply to individual comments on Twitter or X or Facebook. There's some on the right that are saying, oh, this is a power grab. They're trying to regulate everything we say online. That's completely untrue and unfounded. But the idea there would be that you take the current model and you apply it across all platforms on the principle that if you're reaching a certain size of audience and you're providing a certain type of content, then you incur a certain level of social responsibility to make sure that your content is not actually harmful. And by harmful, I'm not getting into an argument about what hate speech is. I'm talking about harmful in the sense of that you're misinforming the public in some sort of significant way, giving them disinformation that could lead them to make decisions that aren't in their own interests. So the idea that should apply across the board, I don't think should be very controversial. You can talk about what level of statutory framework you want. I think we do need a statutory framework, not only an industry framework, but there are some industry bodies like the New Zealand Media Council that operate pretty robustly. You know, they could be the frontline complaints body, and then you could have a statutory regulator behind that that oversees those complaints body. So there are different ways of creating the regulatory architecture for media regulation in the digital era. But I think the very thing that we don't want in an era of disinformation, propaganda, hate speech and so forth is the idea that, oh, well, we just leave it to the market and people can make up their own minds. I just find that grossly irresponsible and malinformed.
That was the Victoria University of Wellington's Peter Thompson on ACT MP Laura McClure's Members Bill proposing the disestablishment of the Broadcasting Standards Authority.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai, ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, visiting scholar and retired lecturer at the Victoria University of Wellington, Geoffrey Bertram, Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa co-chair John Minto, and Associate Media and Communications Professor at the Victoria University of Wellington and board member of the Better Public Media Trust, Peter Thompson. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning into 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.